Joining us in our studio today for the second in our two-part interview is best-selling author Iris Chang. We take up her most recent book, The Chinese in America, A Narrative History, published by Penguin Books. This is really an epic story. It covers the Chinese in America over a 150-year period, and we can't begin to cover it all, but let's at least hit some of the high points, and let's start by looking at a model that historians commonly use, and you use it because it's such an effective way of explaining immigration, but it may not be familiar to all of our audience, essentially the push-pull model. Maybe you could just define that very briefly. What do we mean by the push-pull model?
Well, by that we mean that immigration may be motivated by push-pull forces, a force pushing people out of the country of origin and another force pulling people in.
Right. And this has got to be substantial because it's very difficult. We perhaps minimize how difficult it is for someone to leave your homeland and go to another country. And then the other factor being just because you've decided to leave, it doesn't mean automatically you're going to come to the United States. And in fact, one thing we'll talk about later, if we have time, is that the Chinese did go to other places in the world, not just to the United States.
That's right. During the 19th century, conditions were so bad in China that there was a diaspora of Chinese across the whole world. And the United States was really only one of the many destinations that they headed to.
Okay, let's build on that. Let's talk about the 19th century migration of the Chinese and tell us about that.
Well, the 19th century was a time of floods and famine and civil strife in China itself. And so that was a major push factor. And at the same time, in the United States, there were enormous economic opportunities. And many of the Chinese from the Toishan County region saw the United States as an opportunity to expand upon various entrepreneurial ventures or to find gold, as it was at the time the heyday of the gold rush. And we have to keep in mind that some of the pull factors include a severe manpower shortage in the United States. And just raw physical labor was needed to transform the frontier into land for agriculture, to build the Transcontinental Railroad, to fill the expanding factories. So it was a time of great economic growth for the United States.
Great economic growth and great need, of course, for labor. But Chinese immigration is something very new. In fact, anything outside of generally European and Northern European immigration at this point is new. What's the reception of the Chinese?
Well, in the beginning, before the Chinese became a major threat to white Americans, they were warmly welcomed. Sometimes they even found great success, even in the American South, where two very famous Chinese, Cheng and Ong Bunker, the celebrated Siamese twins, married white women, fathered, I think, 21 children between them, and even owned their own plantations, complete with 33 black slaves. You see, in regions where they weren't really seen as a major threat, they were often embraced as being frugal, as being intelligent, and they were often treated as members of the community. Now, that wasn't always the case when times turned sour, when America suffered an economic depression.
And then what happened?
Well, in the 1870s, during a time of great economic depression, the whites began to fear that the Chinese would take jobs away from them. In the city of San Francisco, there were soon about two white men and one Chinese man looking for every job in the city. And after the stock market had crashed, after the gold mines had emptied out and the labor shortage had disappeared because Civil War veterans were traveling through the country looking for work, many white working men began to see the Chinese as strike breakers, as a great threat to their livelihoods. And they began to organize themselves politically to shut the gates of immigration, Chinese immigration, to this country.
Do you think this is because the Chinese were, and I use this term advisedly, but the most foreign of the immigrants, and that it was easier to deal with and perhaps more difficult to come out against, let's say, the Irish that were coming in large numbers at that time?
Well, the Chinese were, being one of the more recent immigrant groups, was definitely an easy scapegoat for some of these problems.
Okay. You alluded earlier to Chinese going to the South, and so let me ask you to develop that. Most of us perhaps only think of the Chinese in terms of being in California, but yet they really did disperse around the country. So where did they go and why?
They moved across the country to the East Coast, to the Midwest, and to the South. And I don't think it's well known, but there was a time in the American South where white plantation owners considered the idea of replacing black slavery with Chinese labor. What they didn't realize was that the Chinese employees on their plantations would often hire lawyers or agents to negotiate their contracts, hiring translators even to prepare equivalent documents in Chinese, and also suing their employers if they didn't pay them on time.
Interesting idea. Another interesting point to me personally was you make reference to the Chinese in my hometown, North Adams, Massachusetts, in 1870. So for my own edification, tell us a bit about that.
Absolutely. Well, the Chinese were brought into that town as strikebreakers by the Sampson Shoe Factory. And it was quite an event for the town at first, because many of the locals had never seen a Chinese person before. And when they arrived, they were hooted and booed. But very quickly, some of them found acceptance in North Adams. They would attend Sunday school or language classes. Some of them would later marry Caucasian women. Actually, one of the youths who ended up working in North Adams eventually became a major Chinese-American horticulturalist and helped develop a frost-resistant orange that revolutionized the citrus industry in Florida. So it's really an amazing story.
It's a good story. It implies, and I want to make sure to take this up, that the Chinese came to the United States to stay and found acceptance and settled down. Yet you make another important point that historians have tried to develop but perhaps hasn't been popularized, and the idea that most immigrants, Chinese were not alone on this, didn't intend to stay in the United States.
I think that's true for all immigrants, or even people who move often between states in the United States, that we often think this is just going to be temporary. We're going to return to our home communities, not realizing, of course, that with the passage of time, that the immigrant changes and going home is often impossible. Regarding the Chinese who came to this country, many of them had wives in their home villages and children, and they fully intended to make as much money as possible and to return home to their villages. But what they often didn't realize was that their capital would be so valuable in China, thanks to the favorable exchange rates, that there was a vested economic interest in having him remain in the United States, the husband remain in the United States, while sending remittances home to his family. And so you had this paradoxical situation of men sometimes toiling away in menial jobs in laundries or in factories, but their families would live like gentry in the Tuyishan County region in China.
Yeah, that's an important point to make, I think. Tell us about the second wave, which is the wave of immigration following the Communist Revolution in China in 1949.
Well, if we were to describe this in terms of push and pull factors, I would say that the second wave was driven out of China by the Communist Revolution, and this was a highly educated professional wave, a wave that included bureaucrats of the nationalist government and capitalists. And the force that would draw them into the United States, the pull wave, would be the scientific opportunities in this country, especially during the Cold War, when this country sought immigrant brain power to counter the rising threat of the Soviet Empire. And my parents were part of this wave. They fled as small children with their families either shortly before or after 1949 from mainland China to Taiwan. And after going to National Taiwan University, my parents came to this country in the 1960s to study at Harvard University to get their doctorates in physics and biology. Their backgrounds are very similar to that of many of their colleagues who also came in the 60s when immigration laws had relaxed and had undergone great changes under Lyndon Johnson.
Okay, so they came as students and then just stayed on after that?
Yes, as professors.
Of?
Physics and biology. And right. I grew up in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, in that university town where they taught.
Okay. Third wave, the last couple decades, describe that movement.
Well, the third wave came as a result of the lifting of the bamboo curtain and the end of the Cold War, the end of the tensions between the United States and China, and during a great period of economic partnerships and exchanges, especially during the Reagan-Deng years. And this is a wave that encompasses all socioeconomic groups, ranging from the Chinese mogul to professionals who commute between countries. You know, there's that phenomenon of parachute kids and astronauts, which I discuss in my book, people whose families have really been sundered by these economic forces of transnationalism. It also embraces people who are here illegally, sweatshop workers.
Okay. You point to some of the differences among the Chinese that come at these three different time periods. I wonder if you could somehow step back and say, in what ways were they alike?
I think they were all alike in that they all shared a great reverence for education and frugality, family values. Some of them also had an entrepreneurial spirit. You could view the history of the Chinese in America as part of a larger immigration pattern or even economic pattern of the middlemen minority phenomenon. The Chinese, along with certain other ethnic groups such as Jews, Armenians, and Lebanese, are considered some of the great middlemen minority groups in the world, and they serve a specific economic function in which often they will bring a capitalistic role in their host countries and create economies through their entrepreneurial abilities and also facilitate the flow of goods between the producers and the consumers. And it's interesting to note that throughout history, when times are prosperous, the middlemen minorities, the Jews, the Armenians, the Lebanese, and the Chinese, have often greatly prospered and thrived. In fact, I should mention, for example, like all of the billionaires in Southeast Asia are ethnic Chinese. It's an example of that phenomenon. But when economic conditions worsen, these groups are usually the most heavily scapegoated and the most persecuted groups in the world.
Good point. Last question, very quickly. Where else did the Chinese go in large numbers other than the United States?
They went to South America. They've gone all over the world. But some of their greatest influence has been in Southeast Asia, where I had just mentioned they have often very little political power, but tremendous economic power.
You mentioned they're going to the South. Again, I want to come back to that. Did the various immigrant groups had tendencies to go to certain types of areas, whether it be urban or rural or farming or industrial? Did the Chinese have a particular pattern there?
The Chinese tended to be more of an urban people and would assume often specific economic roles, often in retail or in positions where they would pretty much serve as middlemen minorities or often as professionals and intellectuals. But in the United States, it hadn't always been the case. Sometimes they thrived in rural areas too, but would bring crucial services to those regions, such as grocers or small businessmen and merchants. But by and large, they did tend to migrate to the cities.
Okay, well, thank you. This is, as I said in the opening, an epic book, 500 pages of lots of detail and interesting stories. It can serve, I think, both as a reference book for people doing work in immigration as well as just a good read for the popular audience. So congratulations again on a great book.
Thank you so much.
Right, thanks for joining us. You've been listening to Iris Chang, the author of The Chinese in America, A Narrative History, and this is Talking History.